The collapse of the Twin Towers on September 11th gave birth to a strange new world. The site became a place of smoke, dust, and debris. But journalist William Langevische found much more than that among the ruins. Langevische is a writer for the Atlantic Monthly and the author of a book called American Ground, Unbuilding the World Trade Center. He told Anne Strangechamps that the tons of water used to put out the smoldering fires of Ground Zero created eerie rivers that flowed underground.
For a long time, there were open passageways, specifically along the path tracks on the north side, that could be navigated best by boat.
It brings up so many, you know, makes you think of Dante's Inferno or the River Styx. I mean, it brings up sort of mythological images.
The entire underground was like a mythological place. I mean, it was, yes, the River Styx, everyone thought of it at the time. And there were certain hellish aspects to it, specifically the flame and smoke and the realization of all the dead who lay just there. It was also underground, enormously chaotic and unexplored, unknown. There was the unknown aspect to it that made it a very interesting place to be. It was confusing often underground. And on the spelunking expeditions, as they were known as, that surveyed this ever-changing chaos as the collapses continued, people were moving into areas from which there was no guarantee they were coming out. They were taking enormous risks, these survey crews, and exhibiting great courage, actually, without making any show of it.
One of the more bizarre things you described was, I don't remember when in your time this was, but you talked about going through the somewhat ruined shell of the Bankers Trust building, and especially the offices of Deutsche Bank. It just sounded like going through Pompeii, you know, seeing this slice of the interrupted life.
There were these certain places at the site, and the Deutsche Bank executive dining area was really the most extreme. Also, the parts of the PATH station deep underground that were preserved, that had been badly damaged and had been evacuated at the instant, but were preserved from that moment. And you could go into those places, and you for months, it lasted a long, long time, and you could see the moment of abandonment. You could see that sort of the point in which American history shifted right there. You could see what was happening right before the hits, and you could see the reaction that occurred just after. You could even see the way that people evacuated, some people dropping everything and running in a panic, and dropping their keys and leaving their purses and behind. And you could see other places where people, certain rooms, where people had left, obviously in a very orderly manner. And so I think of one in particular, an executive dining room where two people had been having some sort of high-powered brunch or something like that. And they had so carefully put down their napkins and they had so carefully pushed back their chairs. And all of this was very evident because of the covering of Trade Center dust that injected itself during the collapse with the pressure waves. In other words, sometime after the airplanes had hit, it came in and sort of put a gauze on things so you could see what had been disturbed and what had not been disturbed since that gauze had been injected. So it was a sort of, these were perfect museum pieces from American history.
You talked earlier about the culture of the site being really cut off from the rest of American culture. Why was that? Is that just because it was a work site and didn't get covered in general by the press?
Well, the press was excluded. So there's a practical reason for that. The wall, the perimeter wall that surrounded that site was amazingly opaque. You walked through it, you crossed the checkpoints, and you entered with a snap of a finger a world very, very far away from New York City, something much more American than New York itself in a sense. I mean, I often had a sense that this was really not a New York scene, but an American scene. And also the view on the outside was obscured by the images that were being promoted, the hype. So all of the stuff about heroism, there was a confusion between what had occurred on the day of the collapse on September 11th and what was occurring afterward. These were very different things. I mean, what ultimately occurred, of course, was this cartoonish idea of heroic, especially heroic firemen, which had very little to do with what was happening at the site itself. Many of them refused to play that game and sort of scoffed at it all along. Others began to sort of accept it and began to see themselves as they were seen on the outside. You began to see people posing, maybe privately, maybe not for the public, but you could striking heroic poses, looking up at the sky, that kind of stuff. So it was a pervasive thing at the site itself in the end, and it was a very negative thing. I mean, it caused all kinds of resentments. I mean, people were thinking, well, that guy's not a hero, or they were thinking, well, I'm as much of a hero as he is.
Or he wasn't even here that day.
Well, that was the realistic thing, of course. I mean, that we're talking about a very different thing from the day of the collapse. We're talking about the people, some of whom were there, but by definition, who were not caught in the collapse, mm-hmm. who were doing a very different thing from being heroic. They were doing, I think, a much greater thing. The word hero is just, I think we need to put it on a shelf for about 5 years now. It was debased by this, by overuse in the cartoonish aspects. So, in fact, what was happening was a much more positive indication of America than flag-draped heroism. It was a practical response, energetic and highly courageous response, in many ways altruistic response, that said a lot about the inherent strength of the fabric of American society at this time when we were under enormous stress.
To the public outside the site has been largely seen as a burial ground, as a place where so many people died. During the kind of unbuilding and deconstruction, was there intense awareness on site of the presence of the dead?
Always.
All about?
Very much, sure. That was never, ever forgotten. For one thing, you couldn't forget it because the dead were emerging all the time and throughout the duration. I mean, it continued for a long, to the very end, because the dead were distributed all through the ruins. People were very aware of that, and the solemnity of the retrieval process was a big part of the psychology of the site. It was never forgotten what had happened here, never, and people never grew cynical about it.
You end the book by telling us what happened to the actual pieces of steel that had made up the World Trade Center. I guess they went on freighters all over the world, some to China, to Turkey. Why is that the way you chose to end the book?
For two reasons. One, that is the way the story naturally ended. The heavy steel was cut up, resold, and shipped into the world scrap metal market. And also, and I think more fundamentally, because it seemed to me, despite the horror that many people felt about that process, to be the perfect end for those buildings. There was nothing particularly sacred about that material. It was the structure of the World Trade Center. And what better end than to enter world trade? I mean, this was a very tangible destiny. If we believe in world trade and if we build buildings called World Trade buildings, then we should go ahead and accept that fate. I found it to be sort of perfect poetic justice, and also took heart in the idea that that particular steel, the World Trade Center steel, will live on and will circle, will infiltrate into every corner of the world in other forms, be it bicycles, be it refrigerators, be it cars, be it whatever steel is used for. It will permeate the world. There was a lot of that steel, and it was good quality stuff.
Does that seem to you like the American triumph in the face of what the terrorists tried to destroy? After all, what they dislike so much is America's economic domination of the world.
No, I don't quite see it in those terms. I don't think that we could say that the shipping of the steel was a triumph over the terrorists, but a necessary and appropriate fate for that steel. The triumph over the terrorists, which is really what this book is about, was the energy and effectiveness of the response, the very lack of wallowing in sorrow, the very lack of wallowing in victimization, the very lack of heroes, or at least of public heroes, was the real triumph of this story. We allowed a deep inner strength to emerge and a pure expression of American society unspun by the media. I often had the feeling when I was at the site that if only these people who had attacked us could really understand that America is not the television image coming out of Hollywood. You know, America is not sitcoms or, you know, sexy ads or Coca-Cola for that matter. America is not President Bush. America is not all of these things which they see and disdain. America is not the victimization, the wallowing in victimization. These are peripheral things. That what I was looking at was something closer to the true America. And if they could only understand that, which they can't and won't, they would think twice about bothering to attack us again.
William Lungavisha is a writer for the Atlantic Monthly. His book is called American Ground, and Strangeham spoke with him.